This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good morning and welcome to The Line here on Heritage Radio. I'm your host, Eli Sussman. My guest today is Wilson Tang, the owner and operator of several New York City restaurants and concepts. The flagship of his growing restaurant group is Namwa Tea Parlor, which he took over in 2011 from his uncle Wally and infused with new life and excitement and a few hints of modernity while maintaining the classic elements of the menu, dining room, and overall vibe. In addition to Namwa Tea Parlor, which opened nearly 100 years ago, he operates Namwa Nolita and Namwa Kauai, both fast casual concepts, and Namwa 2, which is a casual late-night bar that serves food from chef Jonathan Wu, who has also been a guest on this program before. We'll be talking about what it's like to defy your parents' wishes and get into the restaurant business anyways, how a business degree can be helpful in the epic competition of New York City, and talking about diversification and navigating the world of expansion. Wilson, welcome to The Line.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with Namwa Tea Parlor and your uncle Wally. Take us back to 1950. Tell us how he started there, and how does your uncle's development in the restaurant kind of lead to what has happened today?
Well, so my uncle Wally actually just through the immigration route made his way to New York, and I think as for every first generation immigrant, working at a restaurant is not a desire. It's almost you had to, not because you wanted to, and that's a big deal actually. The wanting to or having to. So he basically had to. You know, he's someone coming from another country. You know, doesn't speak English. So he worked as a dishwasher at the tea parlor for the original family that owned it, the Choi family, and just kind of worked his way through it from dishwasher to cook to manager. And eventually in 1974, he bought the business and the building from the previous family. And from 1974, you know, he just kind of ran it through the decades. You know, we did a lot of wholesale at one point in the 70s and 80s was huge on wholesale. And
Does that mean like making like dim sum dumplings and then freezing them and shipping them or distributing them to restaurants? Or?
So at that time, it wasn't even dim sum and dumplings. It was more mooncakes. Mm-hmm. So we were big on like mooncakes with like the red bean filling or the lotus paste filling, and he would make all of that in-house. And it wasn't until like the 80s where like commercial trade between China and the U.S. opened up, and you know, mooncakes and things of that preserved bakery items started coming over from China, and that's when he saw like the business decline, and that kind of changed it over into more dim sum and tea. So it, you know, through the decades, I want to say, like, you see the business, like, it has its ebbs and flows. It was primarily wholesale for a lot of it, and then, you know, less retail, and then more retail, and now all retail, basically.
For those listening that are not really sure what the moon pies are, can you explain kind of what those consist of? I feel like if you've never been to Chinatown Bakery, it's probably not what they're expecting.
Yeah, so it's a very kind of flaky dough that is actually pressed into like a mold, and then inside this mooncake pastry. is like usually something sweet, like a lotus paste or a red bean, usually also with a egg yolk in it, and it would be all pressed into this mold, and then the pastry will be folded over, and then kind of smacked, the actual mold will be smacked out onto like a bake sheet and just baked with a lot of fat, like lard or egg wash. And it's just something traditionally eaten during Mooncake Festival. But it's really a good, like a very old school snack that people in my culture actually really enjoy.
From what your Uncle Wally told you, in the 70s and 80s, what was Doyer Street like? What was Chinatown like in those years? Now it's so heavily trafficked by not only New Yorkers that live there and utilize it every day as their normal neighborhood, but also a huge amount of tourist population that comes there to experience. We can talk about later whether it's an authentic or maybe an inauthentic Chinatown experience. But what has your Uncle Wally told you about what it was like in the 70s, 80s, 90s before maybe you were too young to remember?
Well, it was definitely a different time in New York. Chinatown, in particular, Doyer Street, was very, very Chinese. I think Chinatown in general in the 70s and 80s was very Chinese. It was really a hub for Chinese people to get together and have a place to shop, to eat, to gather. And there was also like bad parts of it too, where, you know, there was a lot of kind of like gang violence and rival triads during that time. So on Doyer Street particularly, it was that's where a lot of those guys hung out, because it is the it's where Chinatown started. You know, Doyer's, Pell, Mott Street, those are where the epicenter of where Chinatown was. So, you know, for me growing up, it was don't hang out there. You know when we're out when we're in Chinatown on the weekends in the 80s and 90s, it's don't go visit Uncle Wally. If you need to use the bathroom, just get in and get out. Don't hang out there. And while my dad had a lot of business in Chinatown, like I never really hung out at the restaurant that much, because part of it was they just didn't want me hanging out at a restaurant because they wanted me to go to school and not see that part of life. And the other part was just like, hey, there's just too much going on over there. Like, try not to hang out with the wrong people in that area. But Chinatown, it was really an interesting place for me. It was just a lot of commerce and a lot of people buying produce and eating at restaurants and so on and so forth. And I really saw a change like in my early teens, where, you know, the Chinatowns of Flushing and Brooklyn started to really grow and develop, and people in the Chinatowns of Manhattan people in Chinatown were actually getting pushed out because of like real estate issues and overcrowding and stuff like that.
Sorry, I'm coughing so much. I've got that thing that everyone in New York seems to have right now.
Yeah, it's the weather, right? The not hot, not cold.
Yeah, exactly. Excuse me. I want to talk about your dad, actually, since you just brought him up. So they met in Hong Kong.
Yes.
And your dad, I've read, you described his work ethic. Sounds tremendous. He had many jobs at the exact same time.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that sort of the coming to America experience for them?
Sure,
and
sure.
Also, where you grew up, where your parents lived, and what did they do when you were a kid?
Sure. My dad is a hustler. My dad's a hustler. I remember, growing up in I grew up in the 80s. So I remember, days like Saturdays and Sundays, you know, going to work with him. It would consist of driving out into the city, because we actually lived in Queens at the time. Driving into the city, parking the car in Tribeca, and just checking in on places. Like, he had like a real, he had a travel agency office on Mott Street, so we would go there and like kind of settle in and figure out what we have to do for the day. And then he was also like a pro, like he sold Chinese goods, like dry goods, like mushrooms, like canned stuff from Hong Kong and Asia. So he would kind of make his rounds into the restaurants, like he seemed to know everyone. So every restaurant we passed, like, hey, good morning, what's up? Do you need anything? I got this new whatever, right? Like these new mushrooms from Japan or whatever. And at night, him and his brother had a restaurant, a Chinese takeout restaurant on the Upper East Side in the 80s, 80-something street. And I would go with him there, and he would kind of bag takeout and take orders and like bus tables. So like I would spend like 12 hours with him, and it was nonstop from morning to night. And that's how we lived. Like, we, you know, I was a product of immigrant parents, and that's what immigrant parents did to survive.
And so I assume that they wanted a different path for you. Maybe not three jobs at the same time, maybe not 18-hour work days. You ended up going to you were going to a school in Queens, right?
Yep.
In high school, or did you go to school in Manhattan?
I went to high school in Queens, grade school and high school in Queens, primarily because my parents wanted me out of Chinatown. So very early on, and it's so funny today, like we're coming here to Roberta's, and I'm taking the L train, and it was very reminiscent of my youth, because we used to live in Ridgewood, and that's a couple of stops down on the L train on DeKalb. And it's not nearly as nice as it is today, trust me. It was a lot different back in the day. And I grew up essentially in Queens from like grade school like to high school, like a bulk of the years living in Queens. I went to a private school, a Catholic school in Ridgewood. I went to Christ the King High School in Middle Village, Queens. And it wasn't until college that I kind of fully immersed myself back into Manhattan and Chinatown. And I went to Pace University, which is just a stone's throw from Chinatown by City Hall.
Yeah, Pace is very close. So you ended up kind of right back in the mix a little bit.
Yes, totally.
And so was it your choice, a family choice to stay in New York City to go to college? What did you study in college? What were the, did you make your choices about going to Pace and what you studied, or was it sort of partly dictated by your family a little bit?
It was partly dictated. It's kind of, my dad was steering me into that direction. Oh, you should do business, you know, do like finance and accounting. And, you know, at that point I kind of didn't have any other ideas of what I wanted to do. So I just kind of did that. I graduated with a finance degree, an economics degree at Pace University. So yeah, it wasn't really like, I didn't aspire to like go into law or, you know, anything like that. So my dad was like, hey, why don't you just do business? Like, you can't go wrong with a business degree. So that's basically what I did.
So you ended up at Morgan Stanley.
I did. That was actually one of my first jobs out of college. And it was just, you know, in hindsight, like I really kind of didn't think college did anything for me, but it kind of like was the prerequisite of like getting that first job, quote unquote. So I did work at Morgan Stanley as my first job out of school, out of Pace University. And I was there for a couple of years, 3-4 years. So I remember like going to work there. It was at the World Trade Center back then, when it was still here. So I am I am, if you can say, a 9/11 survivor. That really kind of just taught me how to work with people. But it was really not what I was looking to be doing. I kind of just did it for the sake of doing it to get the experience. But I knew, like, very early on, while I was working there, that I needed to do something else. But I did it to just kind of make my parents happy, got this job, wore a suit to work, and so on.
When did you leave Morgan Stanley? And did you know when you were at Morgan Stanley, wow, I really want to be in the restaurant business? Or was there a certain transition point later on down the line where you thought, maybe Morgan Stanley's not for me, but I see something else on the horizon?
Yeah, so it's really funny. I remember talking to my dad about, like, work and life, and I'm like, Dad, you know, this kind of sucks, you know? Like, you know, I'm basically a paper pusher in an office. You know, I clock in at 9, clock out at 5. You know, I'm told when to go to lunch. It's either 11 or 12. And, you know, of course I have my, you know, and for him, he's like, but, you know, you have your weekends to yourself and you get 2 weeks vacation. You start with two weeks vacation and you get 401k. I'm like, cool. But that, you know, like, the 401k doesn't mean anything to me when I'm a 20-year-old. So he had this idea of, like, well, why don't you kind of open a coffee shop? Coffee shop looks like they make money. You know, you're essentially selling water. And then if you make, like, buns and stuff, like pastries, like, it's flour and water. And I'm like, oh, okay, that sounds like a good idea. And at the time, working at Morgan Stanley, I had a colleague that was out in San Francisco. So she was kind of like my counterpart in San Francisco, Serena. And she had a friend, Becky, whose dad owned the bakery. And I reached out, I'm like, hey, what? I wonder if it's possible to kind of come to California and, you know, hang out and also kind of just work at a bakery and see how I like it. He's like, yeah, of course. Just figure out how to get here. And, like, you can come work at my dad's place. It's like, you're not going to get paid, but you feel free to come and hang out. So I actually did that for 9 months. So I was living in San Francisco. You know, I kind of just rented a room at Serena's house, and it was in Santa Clara, so it was in, like, San Jose area, and I would just drive up into the city every morning and learned how to bake bread and how a kitchen works. And I came back, and my dad helped me find, like, a little space, and it was like a friend's building, and, like, they were really lenient on, like, you know, it's like every New York story. You gotta know, like, a good landlord. And it was like, hey, why don't you just try the bakery thing out here? And that's how it all started.
And so that was called, that bakery was called Mr. Tall?
Yeah, so I'm really tall, so I'm like 6'5". And I had no idea what to name this bakery, because it's like my first business, and I'm kind of working at this on my own. There's no, like, partners. So my dad's like, why don't you just ask around, like, ask around, like, your peers and, like, other friends. And I'm like, hey, what do you think I should name my bakery? He's like, hey, you're tall, so why don't you just call him Mr. Tall? I'm like, okay, cool, let's do that. And, like, it wasn't really, like, a thought process to it, but, like, I became Mr. Tall. You know, this is, like, 2004, and this is pre, like, social media and pre-internet. And it was just a little, you know, a coffee shop and bun spot, like, in the Lower East Side, border, like, same neighborhood that I'm in now, like, between Lower East Side and Chinatown. And, you know, I think one of the years we won the Village Voice Award for most interesting restaurant name. So that's my one thing that I got out of a Mr. Tall's bakery.
You must have. It's no longer open.
Correct.
It did close, but
yeah.
There must have been some takeaways from this experience? Obviously, you go, you take a big risk to move to San Francisco. You leave the comfortable, the 401k behind and the sort of like guaranteed payments of an office desk job career. And then you take this big risk of opening up this spot. It doesn't end up necessarily working out the way that you want it. How did that make you feel? You know, when it wasn't a huge smash success, you're a young guy. Did it push you forward even more? Were you sort of terrified? How did you feel?
It was actually a period of very, I felt like failure. I essentially dedicated, you know, 4 years of my life to this in like my prime, like in my mid 20s. And while everyone was out clubbing and, hanging out, right, clubbing and stuff, you know, I'm at a bakery 6 a.m. like baking. And it just, you know, the dollars and cents didn't make it, you know, like I'm like, I can get paid more. I was getting paid more working in a desk job than putting in 16, 17 hours a day. So I'm like, you know, this is not good. So what ended happening was I sold the business. And I remember the first day back into a job, it was actually with my accountant. And my accountant, Harvey, was very supportive of me. He's like, hey, you know, you've got a degree, and if this stuff is not working out for you, why don't you just come and like try to work out of my office and see how it goes for you? Maybe we can take the accounting route again, and so on and so forth. And I remember the first day I went to the office, you know, 9 o'clock. I was there at 8:45, and like no one was there yet. So I call him. I'm like, hey, Harvey, I'm here. You know, we're ready for my first day. He's like, why are you calling me? Like, you know, someone will be in soon. Like, don't call me. And then I'm like, holy crap. I think I just made the biggest mistake of my life at that point, because it meant I had a boss again. It meant, it meant I wasn't an entrepreneur anymore. And, I remember that feeling and that phone call, like it was yesterday. I'm like, oh man, I think I made a mistake by going back into like a corporate environment.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more with Wilson Tang, and we're going to start talking about how he took over Nam Wah Tea Parlor from his uncle Wally. Stick with us here on The Line on Heritage Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
Welcome back to The Line. I'm here with Wilson Tang. He's the owner and operator of Nam Wah and all of its offshoots around New York and also in Philadelphia. let's start talking about Namwa. So you take it over from your Uncle Wally. You, right before the break, had said that after kind of diving back into the, you know, professional, quote unquote, the tie and desk job world, you'd made a massive mistake. So at a certain point, you end up talking to your Uncle Wally, and in 2011, you take over Namwa. What's that feel like to get back into the hospitality, restaurant, food game, and also you're taking over something that has a huge amount of tradition associated with it and a great amount of history? What are your feelings and what are your hopes in 2011 for Namwa?
Well, I also remember this like it was yesterday, but you know, during that break, you know, getting back into the corporate world, the desk job, you know, I really found myself. You know, I ended up meeting my wife now. You know, I ran a bunch of marathons that really kind of answered some like personal goals that I had, and the timing was just perfect. You know, my wife and I were just engaged and about to get married. We were thinking about moving back to San Francisco because we both just love that city. And then my uncle just popped the question, like, "Hey, I think I'm about to retire. You should. I know you were into like baking and stuff. Maybe this could work out for you. Like, just like don't mess it up. Don't F it up." But you should consider. And I remember we went to this other restaurant called Red Egg, which is on Center Street, which was a very kind of modern dim sum place. And we sat there. I'm like, why did we come here? He's like, "Oh, well, I wanted to let you know that like, if you wanted Namwa to look like this, you know, like all kind of modern with the lights and like design and stuff, we can do it like this, you know, so that you can just run it. You know, if you're young and you want to make the place look hip, we can totally do that. And, you know, I just need someone to take it over and continue the story, because, you know, I'd be really upset if we just close the restaurant and it stops." I'm like, "I would just keep it the way it is. It's just, you know, it's old and dingy and crusty. I would just clean it. And, you know, people die for like a restaurant to look like that. And you can't fake it, you know, like you can't fake the patina. Like, I'm like, I would be totally happy running it, to take it over. I would, you know, I had these thoughts of all day dim sum. I had these thoughts of, dim sum for dinner. You know, throughout my, childhood, dim sum was always this breakfast, lunch kind of thing. You wait on the weekends and it's just a big ordeal. And there's always trying to fight for seats, and there's always a lot of people. And I thought, like, hey, dim sum, I can actually do this breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's kind of like tapas if you're at a restaurant, a Spanish restaurant. It'd work great with beer and wine. I would totally like just serve a bunch of beer and get a couple of cool wines in the restaurant, and give it a try. I had these thoughts of almost like a Chinese diner where you get a menu and you kind of pick what you want. So I implemented these kind of little things that I was thinking about as a Chinese American kid, incorporating like the American side of me into it. And we just gave it a whirl. You know, 2011, we reopened in January. We spent some money at the end of 2010 to kind of just clean up the space and like kind of get in new kitchen equipment. It was a very, very minimal kind of expense or kind of reconstruction of sorts. And we opened in like February, right before Chinese New Year in 2011. And at that point, like the internet was really going and like Facebook was a thing. And I was just like, you know, I'm going to open a Facebook page for the restaurant and kind of document the reopening. And that's when people started reaching out through social media, through Facebook. One lady, Gretchen was her name. She was like a editor at Daily News, and she like she wrote me a message on our Facebook page, like, oh man, I was going to this restaurant since I was 8 years old. And you're kind of giving it new life. I got to write a story about it. And lo and behold, like right before we opened, there was a two-page, like before any of the food was spoken about, there's this two-page thing, and I'm like, I got my arms are like crossed, like, and they got a shot of me, in like on this, it's like I'm on the centerfold of this of the Daily News on a Sunday, and that really kind of just put us on the map. That really got, because the restaurant was so old, it got us. All our old customers coming, like, oh, I remember when coming here in the 60s, 70s, 80s, my grandfather, my great grandfather used to take me here, and all of those started coming back by the summer of 2011, and it was such a whirlwind experience for me. You know, then all the press started coming. It was Daily, it was, you know, Wall Street Journal, it was New York Times, and later that year in the summer, you know, first it was LaGaia from New York Times wrote like the 25 and under at that point, that really kind of got the business going. And then 2 months after that, there was another article about just second generation kids coming back to the family business. And it was me again on the front page of the dining section of the Times. And I mean, like real chefs, like chefs, like die for this kind of like coverage and this kind of like stardom or whatever you call it, right? And I was like, look at me, like I'm this just Chinatown kid that took over a restaurant, and like I'm on the cover of the dining section, and that really just kind of kickstarted the whole experience. I think I related more to like the American diner. Meaning person that comes to eat. And it was just, we made it easy. Descriptions, food, beverage, you know, minimal, you know, your Chinatown service, which is kind of quirky in itself. And that really just kind of made, put Nam Hua back on the map.
It's amazing that it's been around for such a long time and that you've been able to sort of revitalize it without losing its original character. Now, as you begin to expand and take the name and sort of spin it off into these other entities, how thoughtful and careful are you of the original brand? And I ask that for two reasons. One, because you're, from a business standpoint, you're mm-hmm. you're protecting a brand that you are now the guardian of.
Yes.
But also, how careful are you to protect those nostalgic memories that people have of the original Nam Hua? Like, if you would have changed the interior like Wally had suggested, it's possible that people would have never come back, right? Because they wouldn't have felt like it's the place they went when
There's
they were
no
8 years old.
Yeah.
Right. So how do you travel down that path and do those things at the same time, like protect, but also you've been on an expansion tear. So how does that work inside your head?
It's actually really, really hard. In full transparency, you know, we tried it in Philly, where we try to replicate the restaurant, you know, same red boots, you know, mid-century lighting, same wall color. It didn't pick up. You know, it's doing fine, but it's not raging. Or it's not doing what I expected. So it even you know, my thought was, oh, it's going to be fine. It actually just turned out okay. And the further expansion, it's fine. Nothing has really been a big pop. But I kind of don't look into, like, this thought process is always morphing. We had in the tea parlor in Chinatown, the OG, we had basically ran out of space to do production of the food. We had to go into like almost a commissary kitchen to just all the handmade dumplings. And it was when we expanded into a commissary, now I'm producing too much. And I actually need to open little stores to kind of take up the product because we've built another business as the central kitchen. And in order for that to work, it needs to do way more volume. So it wasn't really a thought process on like the satellite stores. It was more like, okay, how can I transition this into a form of commerce? And it's not so much restaurant driven. It's more like how do we use the product so that this business can also be successful?
So is the future of Namwa in having the sort of, as you call it, the OG location anchor the brand and having satellite locations that are all kind of different and work in their individual spaces? Or do you have a dream to have like a dumpling, 100 dumpling kiosks that are Namwa fast casual pick up at the counter dumpling kiosks like all over the United States? How do you visualize that future of expansion?
I really do have this picture of like multiple units, but I think just recently with this aggressive expansion that we've done, I haven't really put a lot of thought process in like the human capital of it. Finding good people to run your stores is very, very hard. And so while I think, like, my mindset is still, yes, I want a bunch of stores, at this moment, I really need to, like, settle in and kind of lay down the groundwork to make things successful. So, yes, I do want more stores, but sometimes, honestly, like, less is more. Less is more, and if we can just figure out a good thing, you know, the team is happy, everyone's making money, things are successful, you know, less is more, like just a few is good. I mean, I think I've finally come to that realization, like I'll do another one or two more, but it all has to feel right. And it's also just being able to keep up with the demand and the work, because I kind of find myself like, that's the issue that we're having now. Like, oh, they're like, we can't produce as much, or like this store needs more and we can't get it to them, or this store needs less and we have extra. And like, it's hard to figure out.
Do you have a pretty complicated logistics of delivery, or do you have like a van that goes around? How do you get stuff to all? 'Cause you have five now in the city. So what is a normal like trajectory from production to completion for like 100,000 dumplings or something like that?
Yeah, so the production of it is for that is easy. Like it would be, it's a more of a logistics thing, right? So we have guys on foot with hand trucks if it's close. We have a car that can do the delivery. We also have like a SUV that we can kind of ship down to Philly as well. So I mean, we're still trying to figure it all out. You know, I have aspirations of going into like another market, like Florida or something, and you know, trying to figure out how all those logistics will work.
Do you have investors in the group with you as you went from Namwa Tea Parlor into all these satellites? Mm-hmm. Did you bring in anyone either from just sort of a business mentoring side or an actual investor side to help along with this process?
Well, I didn't take on any investors. I did take on like a business partner to help run the satellite store. So like there's equity, you know, he has equity in those locations. And similar to like Namwa 2, formerly Feng 2, the chef has equity, of course, in that particular store. So I'm actually very open with the equity piece. I feel like that's almost a driver for like the individual to make that individual place successful.
And so with Jonathan, when you sort of swap that restaurant, mm-hmm. can you talk a little bit about that process? How did that come to be? And it just recently happened. Yeah, yeah, so how has it been going? That restaurant was different before the swap and now different after the swap than Namwa Tea Parlor is. So if you can explain to people that have never been to either one, what's that kind of differential like?
Yeah, so Namwa 2, which is our latest kind of brainchild in the Lower East Side, formerly Feng Tu, which was a more elevated Chinese restaurant in the Lower East Side. We decided to rebrand that restaurant because it's been 4 years, 3.5 years, and you know our business was just kind of flat. You know, it just gets by, and it was really a strategic move to kind of fit the neighborhood better. I think the neighborhood, you know, the people that live in the neighborhood, you know, more than 50% of their income goes towards rent, and they really don't have the capacity to dine at a restaurant of that caliber. So our thought process was to kind of inject the Namwa brand into it, but also kind of lower the expectations of the food, and just change the vibe up so that it's more like a drinking establishment instead of this kind of upscale Chinese restaurant. So it's been working pretty good so far. I see a lot of repeat customers because our price points are lower. It's just a more casual, you can come in for a beer and some dumplings, you know, you'll spend less than $20, but you can also get like a nice bottle of natural wine and add a couple of things from the menu, and you know you're now at $40 or $50 or even more. So I think what we did was kind of just be more smart about it and be able to have a bigger reach of clientele, and certainly for more people that live in the neighborhood, I see those kind of people coming in and repeat customers, which we weren't getting at Feng Tu. You know, busy weekends, but like, you know, Sunday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we're always like a drag.
You had a first start with a restaurant business. It didn't go so well. Now, after many years being at the head of the Namwa restaurant group, do you consider this second chapter? Do you consider yourself successful now?
I think I am fairly successful. I think there's a lot more room for improvement. I think my success would be in the growth of the individuals that either work for me or like partner with me. So I'm very much in like a mentoring state right now. It's not about me anymore. I think I did well in my 10 years in my one lease term, right? But I think the future success is really reliant on the people in my organization and how to mentor and grow these individuals and bring on more individuals that are like-minded. But it's really not about me anymore. It's really about the people that I surround myself and seeing their growth and their success.
As Namwa comes up on 100 years and your Uncle Wally bought it in 74. I'm curious, do you have a lease there? Do you own the building? How are you looking towards the future as you see in the restaurant market in New York City? Even Danny Meyer gets kicked out of some of his spaces. How are you going to protect your business going forward?
So I do have a lease. You know, I it's coming. I've got a couple of them. I have like another 5 years on it. My thought process on that is nothing's guaranteed. You know, family or not, this is at the end of the day a business. I hope to keep it going. There's a lot of factors involved. But I'm kind of hedging my bets that it'll go well, but I'm also not banking on it. So that is also, one of the reasons why we've kind of went with the expansion model. You know, we've tied in, especially in Philadelphia, where things are slightly more affordable. We tied in purchasing the premise with the Philadelphia store is at. We just purchased another premise in Philadelphia, and we're trying to figure out what to do with it. So, I think New York is a little too big for me. So we're going to look into like a secondary market to actually purchase the real estate first before we actually do anything with it.
Last question. Your parents weren't too excited about you getting into your dad and your uncle's business. You have two young kids.
Yeah. If
down the line they said they showed a lot of interest, would you be excited or would you be terrified about them taking over for you one day down the line?
I would be totally stoked. I think this business and this line of business takes a lot of hard work and a lot of passion. I kind of don't see it these days, like especially the hard work part of it. We're in an industry that there's a lot of noise, and it's a very hot industry right now. And everyone has all these options. I hope to see like my kids grow up and see the time that I put into my own business and learn from that and be able to put in the hard work and to see them take it to another chapter. Maybe they're the ones that can get us into, 50 stores or whatever. Not in my lifetime, but maybe for them they could.
Wilson, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your story about Namwa. Can you give the address for the original and tell everyone where they can find you?
Sure, absolutely. Namwa Tea Parlor, the original store established in 1920, is located at 13 Doyer Street. That is the cross street for that is Bowery and Pell, easily accessible by public transportation, NR6 to Canal Street, and a short walk from there.
Yeah, and it's awesome. It's a real incredible experience, and the food is, of course, delicious. And you've got a bunch of other spots all around New York City and Philadelphia. They can find those online. Go to the Namwa website, and you can check out all the satellites on that website. Thanks again for joining us, and come listen next week for another episode of The Line here on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.